Let's go ahead and get started. Welcome to the opening panel. We're just getting things started. If you really love antitrust, obviously today's going to be a pretty exciting day. If you don't, I don't know what's going to happen. But first of all, I want to thank Evan and the Law Review for putting together an amazing program and for the panels here, which I'm going to introduce in just a second. My name is John Yoon, as mentioned, and what we're going to talk about today is, in the wake of Google Shopping and the Android decision, the gulf between the EU and the US seems to be growing wider. We're going to find out, is that true, or maybe that's not so true, if we dig into the details. And the stakes are pretty high. We had a paper yesterday by Anu Bradford who talked about the influence of the US and the EU laws across other foreign jurisdictions, and the conclusion was basically the EU is winning, that their laws and how they write their statutes is really influencing foreign jurisdictions as they revise and implement new competition laws. So the stakes are fairly high in terms of how we see antitrust and how we administer antitrust. So today we're going to resolve all those differences. Mm-hmm. But we'll get things started. But let me go ahead and introduce our distinguished panelists. Let me start at the very end with Christina Cafara. She is the Vice President and Head of the European Competition Practice at Charles River Associates. James Cooper, who will arrive at some point, is an Associate Professor here at Scalia Law and the Director of Program on Economics and Privacy. Jan Rybniczek is counsel at Freshfields, Bruckhaus and Derringer. And Hal Singer is the Managing Director of Econ One Research, Senior Fellow at George Washington's Institute for Public Policy. So the way we're going to structure this is that each of the panelists is going to take about 5 minutes. I know a number of them have slides. And then we're going to move into a free-flowing question and answering. And we have the Slido today. So throw your questions at us, and I'm going to see it real time. So this is the first time I'm using Slido. It sounds fun. So let's see how things go. But with that, let me start with let's start at the end. Christina, why don't you go ahead?
Oh, okay. So do we have slides?
I had
some slides for the beginning.
Go up here. Okay.
So am I supposed to go there?
Do you go up?
I thought we were doing it from here. We're not very well organized. I'm Christina Cafara. I'm the European, indeed, in this event. So I thought what I would do is spend a little bit of time putting a European perspective. I do not presume to talk about U.S. law and how things are conducted over here, but of course I practice in Europe and have a strong view about how things are going over there. And I wanted to give you a sense for how things are seen from inside, because my perception when I come over here is that there is a view that is not often terribly well-informed and terribly objective about what goes on in Europe. And so I wanted to give you a view that I hope is a little bit more a little bit more in the weeds. So I want to clear up a couple of things about us, you know, that rabble, that mob of unruly people who do things that are protecting competitors, pursuing fairness, the kind of things that people kind of worry a little bit about. Disclosure statement, it's in the slides. I think it's a very good practice for people to disclose who they work for, and if they're consultants. So I always say that up front. It's there. So first point, and I know this is something that will be debated a bit about today, is the whole discussion about whether there is over and under enforcement and whether there is any sense that concentration trends and margin increases are indicators of that. I want to park that. I know this will be discussed on the panel later, because in Europe we don't sweat that. We really didn't get into that debate very much. It is a debate that I'm aware has been very live in the US, and no less than, you know, there's a recent, yesterday, I think, a paper sort of looking at from the office of the advisors to the president, looking at that and concluding that that's not an issue. We really do not go there because it is not what motivates our current stance on enforcement. The posture we take about the need to tighten up enforcement really has nothing to do with these macro measures of concentration and margins. And we know perfectly well there's lots of controversy around that and how you measure these things. There is all of this work on superstar firms, our own John Van Rienen, professor at MIT, he's a European, he's an author who has done a lot of work in this area. So I think that debate for us is completely beside the point. Is a red herring, is a straw man. When we worry about under-enforcement or over-enforcement, we really have two main factors at play. One is the anxiety, which is diffuse and very present in Europe and animates a lot of people about the power of digital platforms, their pervasiveness, their hold over our lives. And then direct evidence that comes from retrospective, from things that we looked at, that we've seen sectors concentrating from 6 to 5 to 4 to 3 to 2 in multiple non-digital sectors, from pharma to telecoms to cable, and performance has not improved. We haven't seen evidence of great efficiencies. We've seen this telco 4-3 is leading to higher prices in many cases, potential competition not at all relevant or not effective as a constraint on firms' emergence. So this debate, not for us. Now, I think it is quite unquestionable that we've been quite ahead of the game, right? I mean, this is a cover that The Economist put out a few months back, the Determinators, and these are all the faces of the European enforcers. This is an event last year at ABA. And there is a sense in Europe that there is, in fact, more of a denial in a number of quarters over here about the scale of the problem. I'm putting this a bit as a fan piece, but this is Hal Varian, whom you recognize. He is the chief economist of Google, and there is a recent event in Harvard just tells us that, in fact, the seven deadly sins of tech are possibly virtues, and I love some of these things. Competition high, innovation high, acquisition small, entry easy, switching costs low. This is best. Size appropriate. Okay? So these companies are appropriately sized. Cool. I think the third point I'm making quickly is that I think personally, and a lot of us, the substance of these cases is good. I know there is debate about whether shopping or Android are founded. I think that that is not understanding much of what goes on in these cases. These cases, to my mind, these are the shopping case, the other cases that have been pursued, and there's a whole host of others in the pipeline, are economically sound. And I think the European Commission spent close to a decade looking into this. So I think the substance is good. There is a lot more underway, and not just at the European Commission. At the level of the member states, I'll spare you, but there is enormous hub of activity in France, in Germany, in the UK. A lot of these companies, and this is just the digital sectors, are certainly being under the microscope. What I want to point to, though, because it does bug me that often as Europeans we are sort of viewed as this kind of anti-tech, you know, regressive kind of people. What we are doing in Europe is not motivated by tech envy, at least until recently, until now. There's a coda, there's a finale to this, which worries me. But we don't do this to protect competitors. We understand the economics. We got it. We don't think we have much to learn from. And we understand that platforms are not the same. Yes, they different business model. They differ. They do different things. Cool. We don't have a problem with tech in general. We think these companies are great. They innovate a lot. They do wonderful things. But that doesn't mean that they also not they don't do bad things too. And so we understand all of this, right? All of this is kind of taken and not something that motivates the enforcement that we pursue, even though, of course, I mean, you know, there is no question. Look at the number of unicorns in Europe, are very much a fraction of what you see in the US or China. So we are lagging behind, but there is no direct concern over that. Final point, or near final point, regulation is coming super fast down the pipes in Europe, super, super fast. I mean, this is just happening imminently. The UK, which is a very authoritative jurisdiction, has got a very detailed plan for creating a digital regulator, which is going to implement codes of conduct. There is platform regulation at the EC level coming down extremely fast. The last slide is this, and it worries me, because the new commission is a new beast that we don't quite yet understand. And can it all go horribly wrong? There is a possibility that it might. So I'm a supporter of what Europe has done. I think there is a big change underway. And what matters here, you've heard probably a couple of days ago the Commission, Vestager herself, coming out and essentially laying out the bones of a very big regulatory program that will involve AI and data sharing. What worries me is not her, but him. If you've not heard of him, is super important behind all of this. He's the Commissioner for the Internal Market, he's French. And in a nutshell, what's happening in Europe is that as the UK is weighed anchor and is drifting it into mid-Atlantic with Brexit, Europe has become a Franco-German bloc. And what the French and German care about is going to matter. The Italians are irrelevant, the Spanish are irrelevant, anyone else doesn't count. Fringe, doesn't matter. It is entirely France and Germany. He's French, he's the Commissioner for the Internal Market, and he tweets things like this on Sunday. The battle for industrial data starts now, the main battlefield will be Europe. Europe is the world's top industrial continent, says he. We will organize ourselves to win this battle. So this regulation that's coming out is opening up all of the pockets, these shared data, access, creating pools, digital sovereignty, digital autonomy is entirely because of the German and French drive to protect and support German and French manufacturing. And so we know we lost the battle on the consumer digital platforms. We totally did. But there is an anxiety over our data in an American processing center, in an American cloud. We need to get back control, and we need to try and bolster the industrial side of things. This is concerning because it is what animates regulation behind the scenes. Much of it is about that, and I think this is something that has the potential to go horribly wrong. I'll leave it here for now.
Thank you, Christina. James, did you want to have some remarks? And then we'll move to Hal and then Jan.
Sure. I'm the only one without slides. We all started off with agreement not to have slides. And this is like when you teach game theory and collusion. Like, I'm the guy who gets screwed because everyone defected and I'm stuck without slides. But I don't know. You be the judge whether I'm the winner or the loser on this. But anyway, so my role here is to really talk a little more about the role of data and privacy and antitrust and how they're becoming increasingly merged. And maybe this will be disappointing to Christine. I'm actually say that, you know, I don't really see maybe in rhetoric there's a gulf, but in practice I don't really see a large gulf at all between the EU and the US and the way that they've, you know, thought about data and antitrust. You know, so if you look at in practice, if you think about first, you know, you think about some of the big mergers that have involved data, LinkedIn, Microsoft, Yahoo, Verizon, you know, they've been cleared on both sides of the Atlantic, and if you read the EU commentary, it's very sensible. It comes to they don't draw data. They don't make special rules for data markets. They don't. It comes out exactly the same as it does in the U.S. The same about privacy. You think about high profile mergers, Facebook, WhatsApp, or Facebook, Instagram, Google Nest, where there are calls to incorporate both sides of the Atlantic to incorporate privacy explicitly into antitrust analysis, and they've been rejected on both sides of the Atlantic. So I think that actually in practice, again, even though there may be a feeling or maybe there's different rhetoric, but that in practice, I think that the merger that both sides are treating treating data and antitrust about the same, and I think, you know, keeping them in separate lanes, which I think is right. Now, we may talk later about the separate lanes. Certainly, GDPR is a game changer in the privacy regulatory domain. You know, and one place where there has been a little creep is in the German Facebook decision, but that was overruled, and it's on appeal. So let's stay tuned, see where that comes. That's actually merging directly privacy and antitrust, and that's what kind of that now to my concern. I worry about, again, not a chasm between the two sides. I worry that this merger, there are political forces that are driving it on both sides here in the here in the Atlantic, you know, that there seems to be in the U.S. And in Europe, this you hear. Well, sir, I'll just focus on the U.S. that there's this notion that that competition, increased, enhanced antitrust laws, maybe the treacle to cure ills as wide ranging as privacy bias and social bias in social media or social media addiction. Every Democratic candidate has some sort of plan to deal with all the ills of big tech, and famous liberals like Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley do as well. So this is really bipartisan and somewhat, and Barry touched a little bit on this in some of his remarks. I mean, it's bipartisan populism. Where I worry, and I will defer to Christina on the details of this, but I was thinking that you know the recent proposal that I read about, you know, in the EU, it and again the Facebook decision. Stay tuned. We'll see maybe pulling us further down that path. So, you know, just to sum up my brief PowerPointless remarks are that I think that actually that when that we're both sides of the Atlantic are doing it correctly in the sense that we're keeping privacy and data in one lane and antitrust in the other lane. I worry about, again, convergence, but maybe convergence in the wrong direction, that there's this there's a political push on both sides of the Atlantic to merge these areas into one concern. So I'll just I'll leave it at that, and we'll get into more detail as we get into the discussion.
Thanks, James, for that very positive message of unity between the two. I'm liking that. So we'll move next to Hal, and if we could pull up Hal's slides, that would be terrific.
Okay.
Hello, everyone. Good morning. And I'm so thankful and honored to be invited here among such antitrust luminaries. I enjoy serving as the liberal foil at a George Mason antitrust symposium. There's two of us. And I will defend the nanny state today with gusto. It's been a rough stretch for me this week. I was deposed all day yesterday in the foreign exchange antitrust case, and I'm going to be deposed all day Tuesday in the Jimmy John's no poach case, and I'm in the middle of starting up a trial that'll begin on March 2nd in the capacitors antitrust case in San Francisco. So if Jan takes me today, just know that I'm running on fumes right now. Today's panel seeks to spell out the differences between EU and U.S. antitrust, and I happen to have just read Tomas Philippon's wonderful new book called The Great Reversal, which touches exactly on these topics. There's a nice treatment in there about how DG Comp was designed to be independent as part of a grand bargain among various nations, and that independence has led DG Comp to take a more aggressive stance towards monopolists. It also explains, of course, how the burden of proof, his book explains how the burden of proof, unlike in the U.S., falls on the defendants to appeal a DG Comp decision. Of course, that's pivotal. In the U.S., there's no abuse of dominance standard, which means a monopoly can exploit its monopoly power to the fullest so long as it's not doing so with the use of any restraint. So, for example, Amazon can choose not to police fakes so as to extract payments, which are effectively extortion payments, from its brands. Or StubHub can charge a 25% user fee whenever you buy tickets. There's no restraint supporting that. And Hertz, of course, could charge me $10 per gallon to fill up my tank at Tampa International a few days ago when I return it. There's really no restraint there. So it is hard to stop these episodes, at least under any kind of U.S. law, these episodes of exploitation. Now, these differences in standards, of course, have led to differences in enforcement. In the EU, merger enforcement has remained stable, whereas in the U.S., merger enforcement has fallen. And we can see from the recent T-Mobile Sprint decision how much discretion a judge has to credit purported merger efficiencies and therefore condone anti-competitive mergers here. In the EU, the abuse of dominance cases have been stable, whereas Section 2 cases brought by the DOJ has declined. Now, Tomas argues in his book that these differences in antitrust standards are associated with differences in macro outcomes, including differences in labor share and differences in concentration. And so what he shows is that labor share is falling in the U.S., but it's steady in Europe, potentially due to the lack of enforcement against monopsony abuses in the U.S. And let's see if we can, if the UFC or the Jimmy John's monopsony cases, which are both my cases, turn these things around. And that's all I'm going to say about those. We also see market share rising while prices relative to labor costs are increasing in the U.S. And the story here that Tomas and others are saying is that lax enforcement against mergers and monopoly abuses could result in monopoly power in product markets, yielding buying power in the associated labor markets. And here's another look at labor share. It's falling, but critically, this is not happening in Europe. Now, there is an alternative story being spun by David Autour and his co-authors, which you guys are probably familiar with, called the Superstar Firm. And the notion here is that superstar firms are overtaking their respective industries. And they just happen to pay their workers a small portion of the revenues because they're so good at generating revenues. But if generating so much revenue and they don't have monopsony power, the question is, why aren't they sharing a bigger portion of that with their workers? Of course, if their workers are generating higher labor productivity and that higher labor productivity is reflected in those higher revenues, then economic theory would predict, in the absence of monopsony power, that those workers would be paid more. And so while the superstar firm is a story, it's not necessarily a story that's inconsistent with the abuse of monopsony power. So I admit that it's hard to connect the notion of lax antitrust enforcement to these macro measures of labor welfare or price-cost margins. Of course, there's thousands of things going on in the economy that could be affecting those as well. If we talk about labor share, we know that unionization has been falling in the United States, and so there are a lot of things that could be upsetting or weakening workers' bargaining power vis-a-vis their employers. It's not just that lax antitrust enforcement. So what I wanted to do was drill down on one particular industry so that we get to see what it really looks like, the difference in standards. And I wanted to pick the payment card industry. And the theory of harm here, it's very simple, is that the payment card companies, Visa and MasterCard, require merchants to accept all cards. And so this restraint, just as a matter of basic economic theory, would dampen competition, at least on the dimension of merchant fees, by the issuing banks. And the EC here articulated the theory in a slightly different sense. I'll just read you what they said. It's pretty smart. They said, MasterCard's Honor All Cards policy, quote, enables MasterCard's member banks to exert collective market power through the multilateral exchange fee. I'll stop there. It will stop torturing you. But the idea is that in the absence of this restraint, that the issuing banks would be forced to compete on merchant fees to attract the various merchants. And that's not happening. That's what the restraint does. It dampens the elasticity of demand, in this case, among the merchants. And so these differences in treatment, of course, have resulted in differences in outcomes. The EU has seen a settlement with MasterCard in 2007 and with Visa in 2014. Now, the Honor All Cards policy remains, but it remains at a regulated rate. And they basically picked a rate that they thought approximated the marginal cost of the platform. In the U.S., by contrast, we still have this litigation ongoing, and I see two significant obstacles to the plaintiffs prevailing here. I mean, the first question is causation, which is typically what I get hired to do, and the question is, how are you going to establish the increment to merchant fees attributable to this restraint if the restraint is pervasive throughout the entire United States, throughout the entire world? Where's the natural experiment that one could exploit to try to tease out what the incremental effect of the restraint is? And second, I think the Amex decision, which now, foolishly, in my opinion, tolerates offsets to different parties as a way to excuse or justify anti-competitive harms. And as a result of these differences, we see massive differences, as expected, in the merchant fees that are being charged. And so these slides are going to be available. I won't take you through it all, but
Suffice it to say that fees are about 85% lower in Europe as a result of this settlement than the prevailing rates in the United States. And this is not a good thing from an economic perspective, or at least from this economist's perspective. I see it as being inefficient and regressive. We don't like those things. I don't like those things. So when it comes to inefficiency, the problem we have here is the merchants have to do something with those higher fees. And what they do is they just pass it along through in the form of higher prices to end users. And that's economically inefficient because it results in a price effects and output effects in the product markets, despite the fact that more transactions are occurring. The number of transactions on the card are actually irrelevant. But this is the thing, it's the regressive stuff that gets me. You know, when Jan and I get rewarded in part through these high fees, through our reward programs, and so we get our free massages at the American Express Centurion Lounge and the Michelle Bernstein catered lunches, which are fantastic. But every time I eat there or get a free massage, I feel a little guilty paying about what's happening to the cash paying customers at these merchants who are bearing all of the overcharge and don't get to see any offset. And because Jan is incapable of feelings, he doesn't experience those guilty pangs. So, you know, are we winning? Is our regime better than theirs? I don't know if we're winning, but I'll tell you, when I look out and I see some of these indicia of inequality, kind of growing power imbalances in the U.S., higher markups, larger concentration of power, I do worry, and I think that you see it's not just economic power and price effects and things that we economists worry about, but I also see societal fissures that are occurring. We're kind of being torn apart, and I don't mean to suggest that Trump supporters and Sanders supporters are the same, but I do think that they might be, their grievances might be coming from the same place. They might not appreciate the way that they're being treated in our economy. I'm not going to take you through my antitrust agenda. I'm not running for president, and I'm not associated with any campaign. But if I were, it would look something like that. And maybe we'll get a chance to go through some of my ideas as the panel progresses. But thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Hal. I'm the cash paying guy, by the way, if you're in your example. That's me. Jan?
This is yours.
Yep. So, Hal, I'm glad you gave us all comfort that there are plenty of antitrust litigations out there, given that you have three going on at the same time. Either that or you're a monopolist, so we might have to break you up. All right, so I've got just a few slides. I'll do them quickly because I think we probably want to get to the discussion, and they're mostly pictures because I like pictures. So we've all heard the broad claim, you know, lax antitrust enforcement in the U.S. has led to concentration and a host of other problems. Christina mentioned it. It may be a straw man in Europe. It is not a straw man here. It is the basis for a lot of policy proposals in the U.S., and the subject of a lot of debate, and you know, the reason why antitrust, which I'm happy about, is kind of at the forefront of people's attention and minds in a kitchen table conversation piece. How does that relate to tech? Well, the kind of arguments there we'll talk about more, I'm sure, and you've heard about is, you know, big tech is acquiring potential or nascent competitors, and thereby stifling competition. They're erecting barriers that disincentivize incentive because of kill zones and other things, and they're leveraging their platforms to harm rivals and competitors. So Hal asked the question, you know, are we winning? I'm going to try to narrow it to kind of from a competition standpoint, because I think the broader kind of social issues are kind of out of my realm of expertise, and there certainly are many, and I don't think, you know, I can add much value to those. But let's see, are we winning? Well, from a standpoint of, and we'll just go through some facts. I mean, from a standpoint of R&D, which is important to innovation and to new startups and competition. The U.S. leads in R&D. You can see that Amazon and Alphabet or Google are one and two. And then many of the companies here are U.S. companies and many are tech companies. When you drill down and just focus it on U.S., you see that the top five are tech companies. So the suggestion that big tech is somehow stifling innovation, I think these facts are maybe contrary to that. These companies continue to innovate, they continue to compete, and that is all to the benefit of consumers. What else? Christina mentioned this. Unicorn companies. So these are startups or privately held companies with that have reached a value of $1 billion. An overwhelming majority of those are in the U.S., then followed by China. And the amount that are kind of attributable to Europe is relatively small compared to those, but has also been declining over the last two decades. And historically, those have primarily been in the U.K., so as of January, we're going to cut those away as well. And those are kind of the Airbnbs, the Instacarts, the WeWorks of the world, all of which are kind of disruptive and add, I think, value to a lot of consumers' lives. Investment. How are these companies being started? What is fueling them? Well, venture capital. And you look at the venture capital in the United States, it is significantly higher than in Europe, and the number of deals that are generated out of the U.S. versus Europe is significantly higher. So that's a good thing. I think some place where the U.S. is doing well, that investment is spurring these companies and spurring innovation and spurring competition. Labor share. So Hal mentioned labor share, and maybe we'll talk about this more, but I think if you look at the data, you'll see that the decline of labor share is a global phenomenon. It is not something that is happening uniquely in the United States, which then begs the question, well, if it's happening globally, and this is the conclusion that Artur and others have come to, is if it's happening not just in the United States but elsewhere, is it because of lax antitrust enforcement? Certainly, I don't think we would consider Bork to be a figure whose principles are followed by the European Union. And so the notion that the labor share reductions in Europe are attributable to the same type of approach to competition law doesn't seem to hold. So what is it? Well, as Hal mentioned and others, Artur kind of has this superstar theory, which suggests that it's because of productivity gains. And not necessarily because of increased concentration from a reduction of competition. It is increased productivity. And you see it mostly in markets where technology is a key feature of competition. And this is... Well, I'm missing some slides, but it must have been on a previous version. But so why is this all important? Part of it is because these services that the tech companies provide are incredibly valuable and add a lot to consumers. There was a recent study from some economists out of MIT that tried to attribute a value to each of these services, many of which are free, and how much consumers would have to pay to give those up, be willing to pay not to give those up. And you can see the figures here. They're pretty staggering. That some of that is related to the vertical integration that's happened with the different platforms. Some of that, and we'll talk, I'm sure, more about serial acquisitions and acquisition of nascent competitors. But the value that is added by, for example, a Facebook acquisition of Instagram. So can government do better? Can regulators do better? I just found this to be interesting in finding out that it's super substantive, but out of a poll of Americans, many of them trust Amazon and Google much more than the U.S. government, let alone Oprah, which is saying something. And then you have, obviously, the unintended consequences. If you look at GDPR, so the new data privacy regulation in Europe, it's been out, 2 years now, but soon after that rollout, there were some pretty significant consequences from that government intervention into that space. you'll see that incumbent firms, the large incumbent firms who we are, who were concerned about, Google and Facebook and others, actually benefited from that. And the smaller tech companies, ad tech companies, had a harder time. And a lot of that is because of compliance costs, right? So the websites that use these ad services have to have enormous compliance costs as a result of this regulation. And the smaller companies simply weren't able to keep up. And it also had a reduction in the overall number of deals that venture capital was involved in. And this was a study done in 2019 showing that. So that's kind of the landscape. What are the key differences, in my view, that's driving kind of the different approaches between the US and the EU? I think there's a lot of differences we can talk about. Here are the kind of four that kind of strike me as the most significant. One is the regulatory versus law enforcement approach and administrative versus judicial. Having just litigated a case, a merger case in federal court, and having won against the FTC, I'm a big fan of the judicial system and the fact that we have judges who hold regulators to account. In Europe, DG Comp has more discretion to decide what goes and what doesn't. There is an appeals process, but it is relatively long. And for example, in mergers, it is rare, if ever, that a deal can withstand that appeals process. We saw in the TNT UPS decision that DG Comp can be told that they were wrong, but what's it really matter? That deal's long gone, and the parties actually have had other deals since then. The relative importance placed on error cost. In the US, the case law is pretty strong on the role of error cost and the significance of error cost in decisions. My view is that the European approach, and we can talk more about this, is the less of a concern, not no concern, but less of a concern on the risk of error. Monopolization versus abuse of dominance, the standard is just much higher in the US, both in terms of share of what qualifies as a monopolist versus what is dominant, but also in terms of what the requirements are. I mean, in Europe, you have a dominant firm has a special responsibility, in fact, which is something that's a bit foreign to the US. And then consumer welfare considerations. Thankfully, both regimes use the consumer welfare standard. I'd argue that they're applied slightly differently. And the focus on harm to rivals, I think, is much more significant in Europe and kind of triggers almost a presumption that there is then downstream harm to consumers. Maybe that's on the margin, but certainly the idea of rivalry versus the idea of consumer harm is much more significant in Europe.